Good morning. I'll just call our gathering to order. My name is Tom Berger, and this is the Alaska Native Review Commission. It has been established by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, which is an organization of Eskimos in Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. And it is co-sponsored by the World Council of Indigenous People, which is an international organization of Indians and other indigenous people. And the commission's job is to consider the impact of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, to go around to every region of Alaska and to find out what Alaska Natives and Alaskans generally think about ANCSA, the way it's worked out, the good points, the points about which people have complaints, the 1991 issues, the question of the transferability of shares, the question of taxation of land 20 years after conveyance, the question whether or not children born since 1971 should in some way participate in the settlement, and the issue that we found keeps coming up and is in many ways linked to the 1991 issues, and that is, of course, the issue of sovereignty, native government, whatever you wish to call it. We have been holding meetings now since late February. We have been to villages on the west coast, Amonok and Tununuk. We've been to the Otna region and held meetings there in Copper Center and Gulkana last week. And those meetings have all been well attended, and it seems to me that there's a lot on the minds of Alaska Native people, and they have been eager to state their views. I think I should say that they have contributed in a constructive way to consideration of the history of the last 12 years since ANCSA, what has been achieved, the flaws, because some, indeed many, say there are flaws in ANCSA, what's to be done about it, where do they go from here? And I think it's been a useful discussion, and many good points, many insights have been brought forward. We also held some roundtable discussions, public roundtable discussions in Anchorage, to which we invited some of those Native leaders who worked to achieve ANCSA back in the late 60s and early 70s, some presidents of the corporations today came. We asked some village leaders, some elders, and some lawyers. How could we hold a meeting in Alaska without lawyers? And we had Native leaders from the Lower 48 and from other countries, from Canada, Greenland, Australia, and from Norway, who talked about how Native people in all of these various places are grappling with the questions of land and protection and preservation of ancestral lands and the emerging issue of Native government self-determination. And I intend to hold meetings in all of the regions and to hear what people have to say. And we hope to have further roundtable discussions in the fall in Anchorage dealing with questions of the 1991 issues, subsistence, and sovereignty. And we hope that by matching the views of people in the bush, so to speak, their contribution to the proceedings against what is said by Native leaders and experts in Anchorage, we'll come up with a report that will be out in the summer of 1985 that I hope will be useful to Alaska Natives and to Alaskans generally in charting a course for the future. My object is to play a constructive role in a time of what appears to be a time of in Alaska when ideas are bubbling up and change seems to be very much in the air. We had a meeting at the University of Alaska on the campus here in Fairbanks yesterday, and it was well attended, and altogether 33 students and members of faculty made presentations, and I was impressed. In fact, I have found wherever I have been that the meetings have been characterized by two features. The first is that notwithstanding that I was told in Anchorage that people in the villages were not well informed, we have found that in the villages people do understand what 1991 is all about. They may not understand the technical features of the act, and I don't suppose a great many people do, but they understand what the settlement was about. They understand that the corporations hold the land. They understand that if enough people sell their shares after 1991, they could lose control of the corporations and thus lose control of ancestral lands. They understand that there is, 20 years after conveyance of lands, a possibility of liability to a state property tax. And they understand very well the fact that land used for subsistence isn't likely to generate revenue that would enable property taxes to be paid. The issue that is clearest to them, it seems to me, and I suppose you would expect this, is that they understand very well that children born since 1971 have no right to be enrolled as shareholders in ANCSA. They may take by inheritance, but they understand, and many have said to me, you know, two of my children over 13 hold shares. Two of them who were born since 1971 don't hold shares. And they have said, sometimes poignantly, why is the settlement one that includes some of us and doesn't include others? Why is the rising generation excluded? I take the liberty of mentioning these things because I think they do reveal that, so far as I can tell, and it's early days yet, people in the bush are concerned. They do comprehend what is going on, and they're eager to participate. Well, I want to thank you all for coming today. We are going to be holding this meeting all day today and again this evening and then again tomorrow and then on Saturday morning to give people as they come in an opportunity to participate. Jim Sykes is with me and he is taking down on tape all that is said because we will be preparing a transcript of everything that is said at these hearings and these meetings, and that transcript will be available to all of you. In fact, the University of Alaska at Fairbanks wants to be, and as far as I'm concerned, they will be the repository of all the records of the commission and the tapes. But there will be a transcript. It is already being produced week by week, and we will be happy to make arrangements to see that that is sent up here to Fairbanks, to the organizations that that you represent. When I write the report I've been asked to write, it will be based on what is said at these meetings. That's the purpose of the exercise. I hope that in the end that report will be useful to Alaska Natives in planning their future. The only other thing I might say is that there has been quite a lot of interest in the lower 48 in what is going on in Alaska and in a secondary way in the work of this commission, and there has been interest expressed as well in other countries where they are considering their land claims. You were pioneers. You settled your land claims back in 1971. The people in other countries, Native people especially, of course, have been watching the progress of ANCSA. They're interested to know how it has worked out. That means that they have an especial interest in the views that people like yourselves express at these meetings and hearings, and in the outcome here in Alaska, and in a secondary way, as I say, in the work of this commission and the report that we intend to write. So that at a time when Alaskans, even if this review commission didn't exist, you would be taking a look at ANCSA, and I think that people in the lower 48 and in other countries, Native people, are very interested to know what your views are and where you want to go from here. So that's my purpose in being here, so that we can have taken down all that is said and on tape. I could just slide over this way a bit, and each of you, as you speak, if you wouldn't mind just being seated at this microphone, and that way you'll be speaking to all of us, and it's all very informal, and I hope it doesn't turn into a kind of a public meeting. I know it is, but I think it's an opportunity for an exchange, a presentation of views in an informal way. Some of you have been kind enough to give me your names already, Spud Williams of Tanana Chiefs, Gene George of Stevens Village, Richard Frank of Minto, Sam Dementia of Fairbanks, and Mary Jane Fate have all put their names down, and I hope you'll feel free now to come up and tell us about this. Wonder, Mr. Williams, could we start with you? And
thank you, Mr. Berger. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify at your hearings. In your opening editorial, you've stated most of the things I was going to talk about. I would hope that other participants, though, in listening to your editorial, would not feel that those views expressed by you are necessarily the views that you're looking for, and that they would use their own presentations and not be led by previous speakers or the hearing officer. I left a little piece of paper at the desk when I came in. It was something I picked up a few days ago, and it seemed appropriate for the Berger Commission hearings. And it's called The Six Stages of a Project. And when we look back at the Claim Settlement Act, it seems to be appropriate when we're reviewing today some of the impacts and where we've been and where we're going with this settlement. And the stages are, number one, enthusiasm. Because when it first started, well, who's to say when it first started? Because for those that have really been involved in the Claim Settlement Act, it started probably 100 years ago, at least that long ago. And it surely started in the early 1900s when the Alaska Railroad started coming through the country. And the chiefs from the Tanana Chiefs region met with some of the government officials and discussed the land claims issues then. And basically, the discussion was, what the hell are you doing in our country? And they tried to herd them into little tiny pieces of land, and they said, hell no, leave us alone. They had a very clear understanding of land concepts, that the land belonged to the people, and that the concept of ownership that was being impressed upon them was something so foreign that there was no real understanding of it in the initial stages of those discussions. We came to a stage in 71 and probably 10 years prior to that when the understanding was being impressed upon Native people that if you don't take some sort of formal action now, it will probably be too late. because the concept of Western land ownership was not something that was going to be turned around. We were stuck with it. And you could see all the land disappearing under pieces of paper called deeds and claims. And there was no, or it was becoming apparent that there would soon be no land left for any kind of a Native Claim Settlement Act. The Statehood Act had gone through, and there was a large segment of land being claimed by the state itself, with no real legal right to make those claims. Everybody knew that. Federal government knew it, the state knew it. But until the oil companies got involved and there was big bucks involved, I mean, here's a private enterprise that spent $1 billion in staking claim to the North Slope. Land title became very critical. Because, as everybody knows, if you try to do something on a piece of land without clear title, you will not get financing to proceed with those projects. And so the oil companies, in order to get financing for a major investment that involved the whole United States in energy and in all the ramifications that entails, finally gave the impetus to the federal government, the state government, and everybody else to maybe sit down with Alaska Natives and talk. And we by then also understood that if we didn't sit down and talk, that we would just be shoved aside and forgotten. And so great enthusiasm at that time, maybe somewhat cautious on behalf of some people, but enthusiasm nonetheless, because in 1971 at the Alaska Methodist University, when Nixon came over the hookup speaker at that campus and said, I have just now signed into law the Alaska Claim Settlement Act, and most of the people got up and cheered. There was still some caution and there was some dissenters, and the one that comes to mind is Joseph Eupixon at the time, who got up and voted no. And that was the only region at the time that didn't vote no on the Claim Settlement Act. He did not vote yes. So the North Slope even then was totally opposed to this act and the settlement in the way that it did finally evolve and was put into law. So it's no wonder that the Inupiat community is one of the main sponsors of this hearing process and this study. The next stage that came along was disillusionment. Because after all of the enthusiasm, we had time to sit down and start studying what the final settlement was. And the lawyers started getting involved, and the interpretations to the laws started to be brought forward that, you know, this simple piece of paper means a lot more and has other meanings than was intended by those people who made that settlement. And the disillusionment period probably started fairly soon after the document was signed. I mean, anybody who's worked with that document realizes how complicated a document it is. In settling a claim that's 200 years old, in settling the issues of lands and settling the Native land settlement in all its complexities cannot be done in just a few months and put on paper and mean the same thing that everybody intended it to mean when they wrote those words down. And so the disillusionment in the first couple of years after the settlement started to set in. The lawyers started getting their hooks into it. The government started getting their hooks into it. The state started getting their hooks into it. And everybody started interpreting this document differently. Then the third stage set in, panic. What the hell have we done? You know, is this really what we meant when we said those things? Is this really the intention? And most of the people that were involved realized that things were being construed totally differently than was intended at the time. And those that were not involved were becoming aware that something was been put upon them that they really didn't have an involvement in, and were starting to wonder why they were being subjected to it. And the fourth stage we've been going through for the last few years is search for the guilty. In the first stages of enthusiasm, everybody involved were heroes. But in the fourth stage now, they've been termed the guilty. And so we're still searching for the guilty today. Number five is one of the consequences that we're starting to realize, and that's punishment of the innocent. You mentioned the people born after 1971. Had no participation, and certainly could not have had any understanding of the consequences. Whether or not they have any recourse is yet to be decided. But nonetheless, they are going to be punished. And number six is kind of facetious, but seems to be starting, and that's praise and glory for those guys not involved. Because in every action, somebody does have to take the lead. And even though today we're kind of accusing them of being the guilty, they had the guts enough to get out there and do something at a time that it had to be done. But we seem to be praising a new group that really wasn't involved, and in some cases don't understand the true issues of the time or why those actions were taken when they were taken and why they had to be taken at that time. And so they are out there trying to get the glory. And that is through disassociation, which I think is a bad way to do it. The Claim Settlement Act is a fact. I don't think any way, shape, or form that we can get the thing overturned, thrown out, or any other thing. It's something that we're going to have to live with. I'm not saying we have to live with it in its form as it is now. It can be massaged and fixed, and that's part of the purposes of these hearings and the 85 studies and other actions that have gone on and will continue to go on. But in those early days, the land was always the primary goal that the Native community was trying to secure. The land was the most paramount issue, the most important issue of the act, and in reality, it was the only issue. All the other things that we've been trapped into this act were side issues. Some of them were sucker issues. Some of them were blackmail issues. But the only thing that was of primary importance was the land itself. When you say Native people, culture, land, it's almost all the same word. Because the people are the land and the land are the people. You can't separate the two. But in the act, land has been given a different meaning than the true meaning or the native interpretation of lands. And that's when land started to be represented by a piece of paper instead of the concept, the spiritual concept, as land as the provider in home. It became a piece of stock. And that land concept is part of the disillusionment of the Claim Settlement Act. It has gone so far as that those communities that are truly native, the very ground that they live on, that their homes are situated on, in most cases, the core township itself is owned by them but controlled by the state. The very core of every Native community that is not incorporated is held in trust by the state. I don't think any of the original drafters intended that to happen. In talking to a lot of the original Native drafters and participants, it was something that was overlooked, that the state would come in and actually control the very communities of the people that were intended to be protected under this Claim Settlement Act. The ownership concepts of the lands themselves becoming a piece of paper as opposed to a communal enterprise, which land had been in the past, people are finally coming to realize is the destruction of Native ownership of lands as the act is now written. And some are even coming to the conclusion that was the full intent of the act. That since the act was passed, 25% of that land passed through inheritance or divorce decrees or whatever means that that land can be passed through that piece of paper has now passed to non-natives. And that's one of the findings that has been discovered in the 85 study. And if you just follow that trend out in its natural occurrences, it does mean the loss of Native lands to non-natives, which was never the intent of the Claim Settlement Act. The Claim Settlement Act was for the protection of what little land we had left. Because if you remember, at one time, it was all Native land. And I still get a little upset and sick at times when at meetings we are told Natives are never satisfied. We gave you 40 million acres. We gave you $1 billion. What the hell more do you want? And I always have to come back with the statement that you never gave us shit. You stole 325 million acres, and we were forced to sell you that for $1 billion. So the conception that anybody gave us anything is totally backwards. So the protection of the lands under that act, under the original concepts that most natives went into that act envisioning happening, are being totally destroyed. That under the present circumstances, if you just follow the natural trends of what is happening, there are not many years left of Native control or ownership of lands. And that does cause panic, and you are starting to see some of that panic surface now. Hopefully the panic will level off to a point where we can sit down and do some things constructive. Because like I said earlier, the act as a fact is something we're going to have to live with and utilize and work within and hopefully change to turn around to mean what it was supposed to mean in the beginning. Some of the other impacts probably would have happened anyway, but they have been sped up considerably by the Claim Settlement Act. And those are our cultural evolvement. In one way, the act enhanced that because for years, like in every country, there has to be somebody on the bottom rung. I mean, it's just a symptom of any Western civilization that you have top rungs and bottom rungs, and they say that America is a classless people, but that's a total misnomer. America is a very class-oriented system based mainly on wealth, and wealth perceived in a Western system, not in a Native system. And so those that had the wealth at the time were non-Natives. And the concept of wealth after the Claim Settlement Act, every Native in this country was a millionaire. At least that was in the minds of the public. and in some cases still is. As bad as it is, thank God every now and then we see a corporation failing, because then people take a realistic look at where natives really are. As bad as that is, it does wake people up to the fact that every native on the street is not a millionaire. But during the initial stages after the Claim Settlement Act, everybody had the impression that every native was a millionaire. And so in the Western society and the way they structure class, natives really came up in that ladder. They were right on the top rungs with everybody else, and it was surprising. Before, you weren't getting hustled by every hustler in the street trying to sell this flim-flam gimmick and this option, and this consultant wasn't chasing you and that lawyer wasn't chasing you. But after the Claim Settlement Act, they would just swarm around natives. And today, some of that is still happening. That boost that we needed as a people in that system. Now, that really didn't affect those in villages, because they knew what was really important. And in their own communities, they had their own systems of who was important and who wasn't, and those systems still worked. But when you came to Anchorage and Fairbanks, you fell into this system, and for a while, natives were equal, and they took the leadership roles, and I think we're still taking those today because of the Claim Settlement Act. So that was probably one of the more positive acts positive aspects of the act. It did push us forward much faster than we would have without the act. We were forced into roles and given those roles that we would never have had the opportunities to take. We were put in positions where we were able to exercise both economic power and political power. And we're learning to use those tools fairly rapidly. The cultural aspects of that impact, in some ways, were good, because it was then okay to be native. Those things that were native, because you had the money to be part of the total society, were accepted. They were no longer, the native dances were important again, because people were proud to be native and they wanted to show that they were proud to be native. And the cultural aspects of nativeness, the surface cultural aspects of nativeness, were important things to bring forward. And it was pride in bringing those things out. And that part is still going on. The languages that were almost dead in a lot of cases are now being brought back. The customs that people were suppressing are now coming back with pride. The dances and those religious ceremonies that were almost totally killed are being brought back and utilized again. The potlatch systems and the burial ceremonies and the religious ceremonies of honor and dress, and instead of just the one or two potlatches that had survived, we've now brought back four or five of the different potlatch systems. And those things are now becoming important events again in day-to-day Native lifestyles. And people aren't ashamed of being Native. They are proud to be Native. And for a while, before the act, with the assimilation policies of both the federal and the state government, when people were punished for speaking their own language, when the churches were suppressing every, whether it was religious or non-religious function or ceremony, were suppressing everything that was native, that even in your own homes, that your parents had been assimilated to a degree that they felt that the only thing and the best thing for every Native child was to become white, most of those things have finally gone away. So there is one very positive aspect of the Claims Settlement Act. It's still going to be a long struggle now to maintain those two systems in a way that they can be compatible and work together. And we're starting to see some of those fights now in the political arenas. And that's in the areas of the native governments. Because the Claims Settlement Act did bring to light the issue of governmental powers, authorities, and those functions that natives had been doing by themselves for years with nobody's interference. The Claims Settlement Act now, in some people's mind, did away with those things. And again, let me stress that the Claims Settlement Act was only a lands settlement act. It did speak to a couple other issues. One of them was Aboriginal hunting and fishing, and I call that one of the sucker blackmail items that was put into the act, that those that drafted it were forced to give up at the time of the settlement. But there was nothing in the act that spoke to native governments, because there was no intention of any of the drafters that those functions would be monkeyed with. I mean, you're talking of governments that are 6,000 years old or even older. And when you consider an American government that's only just a few hundred years old as compared to governments that are 6,000 years old, it's a little incredulous today that the state or anyone would be challenging those governments as being legal governments or legal entities. But the Claims Settlement Act did highlight and bring forward Native activities and the government aspects of those tribal governments is right now being brought to the forefront as an issue. And the misconception of the act is part of that problem. Those of you who followed the IRA issue can realize that the misconceptions that have been given to the act. The Statehood Act does not speak about Native governments. The sale of the state, or the so-called sale of the state by Russia to the United States government, speaks around the issue of natives and native governments. The U.S. Congress, in addressing governments in the lower 48 and then finally in Alaska in the IRA Act, speaks to native governments. The native governments themselves speak about native governments and deal with governmental issues on a day-to-day and year-to-year basis, and they have for centuries. So I find it a little inconsistent that people would be trying to use this act as a means to extinguish those powers and governments of Native people in this state. But those governments, because of the act, are now taking a different outlook on one of their functions. And that function has to do with land. And the differentiation between this act, I think, and the acts previous to the Alaska Claims Settlement Act was that in most cases, the land and resources and the governments and the people were left as one unit. In this act, they were split, that all of the resources and lands that usually are the function of a government were split away from the government. And again, those that subscribe to the conspiracy theory was very intentional. Conspiracy being that they had no intention of any native holding any land for very long. But the aspect of a government to hold land, to govern that land, to be the trustee for that land, so that that land cannot be taken through just normal business means of taxation, impoundment, or whatever from the people and its future heirs, is a function that the traditional tribal governments are now looking at very closely. It's a function that in history they had a responsibility for, and they did negotiate land uses with regard to resource habitat, resource harvesting, and those aspects that involved tribal government in the early days, are now having to look at the concepts and the Western concepts of Western land ownership and the governmental function of land management and for protection purposes. And in the case where the state owns the very land around them that in the villages that they don't actually live on, and people finally started realizing that the state was trying to take everything away from them, that this issue became very important. It might be getting blown out of proportion a little bit now because of the emotionalism with it, but when you're talking about the very birthright that you thought you had saved in this act, you have to expect some emotionalism. But I think, if anything, that in these studies and the solutions that are being sought by both this study, by the AFN and the retreats and the actions that AFN has taken, by the actions of the regional corporations in studying the issues, both the profits and the nonprofits, in the actions of the villages that are addressing the issue, if that one thing, the policy of the retention of native land by natives, at least in their very core township areas, can be addressed and solved, I think you'll have solved one of the major weaknesses of the Claim Settlement Act itself. Because no matter what happens over the next 100 or 200 years, if all the land is taken away, and all of the assets that were transferred in this act are lost or taken away, there will still be natives. And anybody that has studied history throughout the years and have studied the history of people without a country, without land, realize the traumas that those peoples go through and the consequences of those traumas, realize the impacts that that can have on a people and a nation. And the Jewish community is probably one of the more prime examples of a people that had a land and then didn't have a land, and the consequences in the world impacts that that had. And I think the same impacts will be felt in this country if that does happen. And those can be very, very unconstructive, very destructive on a people and a country and a state and a nation. And that's one of the things I think that this commission should really study and try to find some solutions for. Thank you.
Mr. Williams, thank you very much. Well, that was a most thoughtful historical examination of the Act in the very broadest context, and I'm grateful to Mr. Williams for opening the discussion in that way. I have these names down, but please feel free to proceed in any order you wish. But I have Gene George. Thank you.
Honorable Judge Thomas Berger, first of all, I want to thank the International Circumpolar Conference for this study that they are doing in behalf of the Native people. An independent study would be more trustworthy for such hearings that you are holding. My name is Gene A. George from Stevens Village, Alaska. Let me begin my statement. I remember our village in the early 50s when there was only a mail plane arriving two times a week or so. The only white people were the school teachers and some that floated down the Yukon River and employees that worked on the riverboat, which came to the village. It arrived about twice during the summer and late fall. Our people subsisted off the land just like they are doing today. I remember that moose was plentiful and could be seen from the bank of the Yukon right in front of our village. Trappers, and I mean expert trappers, among those is my father, along with other men of the village who respected the law of trust. If your trap line was handed down to you through the family, in those days no one could use your line without your permission. Trapping extended farther than the land that is now selected by the village under the Prejudiced Land Claims Act of 1971. I witnessed the friendly association between the white men and the natives. When they were in need, they were taken to the best hunting grounds and places where berries were plentiful. If they wanted to fish our best creeks, this was made known to them. Nowadays, it's all sport, all fun and no work. Catch one, throw it back with a torn mouth or throat, or just leave it on the beach. When they asked if there was any minerals around, maybe to take a bath in, then that too was made known to them. Gold, oil, and other valuable minerals were also on that list. I must include this in my statement, for many things come from my heart, like the wind that blows upon the land that was one time controlled by our people. Like the Indians in the lower 48 states, we were taken advantage of by the fact that our educational level was in the wrong place. The laws of this land speaks for itself. That the white man's laws were being written without consideration of the natives, and they are still being written today as such. I remember one prominent senator of Alaska pushing for flooding all of the land. This was to be done by building a huge dam to provide power for themselves and their cousins. Thank God it did not work. There was a study done by the government back then. I have not seen or heard about it. Now, I do not know if this incident was a part of that study or not, but it happened during that time. In one village that I know of, on a clear, peaceful day, the United States Army came to the village with red crosses on their airplanes. They went about their business quickly and without much explanation. All the residents of the village were subjected to physical examinations, of all places, the community hall, where there was not much privacy. Then off they went with the information that they gathered on men, women, and children. What happened to that information, I do not know. Nor do I know what it was for. There is a number of things that has happened to the villages without permission or knowledge of the people. Our village submitted applications numerous times for a reservation. The United States government turned a deaf ear and lost their eyesight, for they couldn't find our paperwork in the files of bureaucracy. Far as I know, there is still no action taken by them in giving us our choice of a reservation. Instead, we are being subjected by law without a vote or consensus of the people in the villages under terms of the Land Claims Act of 1971. Let me now move into the late 60s. In 1968, oil was discovered on the North Slope. Our village was directly on that route. Mr. Walter Hickel, former governor of Alaska, was named for the infamous Hickel Highway, which went through our lands without consulting in the village or its people. Then this started the Deceiving and Prejudiced Land Claims Act. At that time, never before in the history of Alaska, our beloved land, did the white man begin arriving not with Gatling guns or repeating rifles, but with the leather of the law to discriminate and take away our lands and lifestyle, taking advantage once again of our intellect. Native leaders took advantage of the situation also. Not all of them, may I add. They sold us for $1 and the right to work on the pipeline for X number of years. The Land Claims Act was used to open the way for the oil to flow to the lower 48 and elsewhere. Some native leaders jumped at the opportunity to get some of the pie and were quite successful. All of a sudden, we were being represented by various lawyers and individuals, among which were native leaders running organizations such as the Tanana Chiefs Incorporated and the Alaska Federation of Natives. The Congress took it upon themselves to believe these groups and the native leaders without due consideration of the village population. We were never given the opportunity to vote for membership in these organizations. They were thrust upon us just like the Land Claims Act was. It has been several years since the act was in force. Our village was put on the back pages of history, and the pipeline is flowing by with oil worth billions of dollars. Our village received title to land that is much smaller than we asked for in a reservation status. Our village was not given the right to own minerals underneath the land so mentioned in the act. Our village did not see the $1. If they did, I did not see it. Then where did it go? Our village, men and women, did not work that much on the pipeline as agreed to. Our village lands were taken by the letter of the law, and other people from other villages filed for native allotments at the Yukon River Bridge and is receiving title to them. Other non-natives was given lease rights to own business in this area, and our village was not duly considered. Our village witnessed the flagrant abuse of fishing game on our traditional lands. Our village was never consulted or asked to vote, or was there an impact study done about the effects of the pipeline and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. Our village was cut to the very heart by the white man's laws. May I interject this statement? Mr. Ted Stevens, Senator from Alaska, made public statements on public TV this past winter. I cannot quote him on this, but this is what I understood from the statement. This is a state problem, meaning sovereignty. His statement brought out that he makes the laws and the natives break them. False. Our village is subject to state and federal laws like everyone else in Alaska. This is not a state problem. This is a federal problem. Hear me, Mr. Ted Stevens. This is a federal problem. It is a problem of the federal government when lawyers or representatives make laws that are prejudiced to the native peoples of Alaska. Cultural extension of our native peoples begin with the non-native's greed for minerals, land, and money. Without knowledge among our people, laws were made and are continuing to be made for the assimilation of our race. The Alaska Native Land Claims Act itself is the very axe that would fall on the heads of native men, women, and children to extinguish our right to pursue the peaceful coexistence with a non-native world and to enjoy our way of life. To protect the land in its natural state, protect the game as a subsistence way of life, and to fish the lakes, streams, rivers, as the need may be to survive. May I ask, is it not the motto of the United States government to give its citizens the right to pursue life, liberty, and happiness? Instead, the United States government makes laws that are prejudiced, and if they are not satisfied with it, they change it when they want. The act itself took and set aside land for a right-of-way for the pipeline, Section 17C. These lands were excluded from selection by the village people. Soon after the act became law, natives started trying to claim lands that were not only for subsistence, but valuable in minerals. An interior aide back in 1972 in Anchorage told Alaska natives, "Your first settlement priorities should be enrollment of the people and organization of regional and village corporations." In other words, get your name down on paper so you won't miss out on the 40 million acres and the $900 million or so. The government gophers kept the natives busy with simple things of the act and not with the fine lines which took away their rights over a period of time. Now the natives, after biting the bait, have felt the hook and it hurts. The courts have always ruled in favor of precedent cases and refused to rule on cases that have passed a certain number of years without any lawsuits filed or any question as to the ethics of such laws. This, my native friends, is what has happened with the Alaska Native Land Claims Act of 1971 being public law 92-203. In closing, may I bring these points out. One, the act was thrust upon the natives without a vote or consensus of the population. Number two, the village corporations only has title to the surface. That's the berries, dry wood, and what game is left walking on it. That last one is a toss-up with the state of Alaska. Number three, Congress is now studying the effects of that Land Claims Act has had on the natives. This study is after the fact. It is too late to do away with it. We can only voice our needs and hope that the wax will fall out of their ears to give the village some needed changes so that they can survive in the business world. One way that can happen is to change the 7I section and to give back the villages the subsurface. Once again, I want to thank you for this opportunity to give my presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. George. Thank you very much. Next name I have is Richard Frank. Did you want to speak now, Mr. Frank? All right. Sam Dementiev.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Berger. Thank you for inviting me to speak today. First of all, I'd like to say, as an officer of the Regional Corporation Doyle Unlimited, that we have some reluctance to participate in the Alaska Native Review because of the independence in the report when it comes out, that there's a good possibility that everything that's said here could be used one way or another. And what I'm talking about is if the observations and the conclusions of your report come out in a way that could hurt us in our settlement, that's our concern today. And there is somewhat of a 50-50 chance of the conclusions benefiting us too. So that's my reason for being here today. And I'd just like to tell you a few things about my own observations and experience in ANCSA. ANCSA is a Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is a land settlement. And I think that as a regional corporation, Doyle Unlimited chose wisely to hold off receiving title to lands as long as they could so they could make sure that there isn't any clouded title or any inconsistencies or uncertainties in the land title itself, such as public access, rights of way, and other things concerning land title. This settlement is today 12 years old, and today Doyle Unlimited still does not have all of its land. So as a land claim settlement, which happened in 1971, we are 12 years later, and we still don't have full title, but we're doing that purposely ourselves to make sure that we have a clear title of the land. The for-profit corporations, I think today, is still misunderstood, and I think that some of the problems in the corporations are the understanding of what the corporation is, what it is, how it operates, who it represents, how it deals with the assets it has, such as land and money. I think there is the shareholders as owners is a confusing thing, too. The shareholders they know they own land, they know they own money, but they don't own it themselves as a person. It is owned by the corporation, so that's another part that is a problem. Another problem is the original shareholders versus the non-participants, like you mentioned earlier. That is a problem because we have everybody that was born after 1971 as non-participants. They don't have any shares in the corporations. That is a problem. I think that needs to be looked at and hopefully solved some way. The ownership of the land is another problem. Who does own the land? If you go out to a village, you can talk to the village people, and they think they own land, but they don't actually own the land. The village and or the regional corporation owns the land, and their shareholders owning shares in the corporation, so they don't own directly the land title themselves. It belongs to the corporation of which they're members. Another thing is the election procedures in a for-profit corporation that we operate under is the cumulative voting process. And I think that's one of the problems that we have to deal with all the time. It's not fully understood in some instances how it operates. And it's generally understood that if you have a voting process that whoever gets the most votes wins. But that's not quite the case in cumulative voting. It's a real hard and cumbersome process to work with. And I think that is another problem that we have to deal with. Number six is the corporate responsibilities versus shareholder subsistence lifestyle. The corporate responsibilities are to make a profit, to make as much money as they can, and to develop land, their land if possible, or if it's deemed necessary. And that is versing, or that is something that is a vital concern to shareholders in a subsistence lifestyle in the village. If the for-profit corporation does go ahead with its goal to make money and also wants to develop the land, there's a problem in how they work that out with the village people, who are also shareholders of the same corporation. The shareholders, in turn, are trying to respond to retaining their culture, and I think the profit corporation is trying to do the same thing, so there's a clash there, and that's where I'm trying to point out at this time is there's a problem there. Number seven is understanding what is truly represented in the 100 shares of the Settlement Act itself. The 100 shares represents the past life of the Native people, represents the culture, the land, the lifestyle, village living. And this portion, this 100 shares, is something that's going to become available for resale to the public, for sale to public in 1991. And I don't think that's really fully understood in some cases by the shareholders, is that that's a danger. It's a true danger, and I'm right now I think people are beginning to understand it, and I hope that the process of understanding what is truly represented in the 100 shares is finished or continues. The